It's Twin Bills, the Red Sox podcast from the sports department of the Providence Journal, featuring Red Sox beat writer Bill Koch, along with sports editor Bill Corey. Now, Twin Bills.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Twin Bills Red Sox podcast. This is Providence Journal sports editor Bill Corey, and with me is Bill Koch, our Red Sox beat writer, fresh off a plane from Los Angeles not too long ago. Catching up on your sleep, I hope, Bill?
A little bit today, Bill. It's nice to be home, and you know, I won't say it's nice to end the season. It's always sort of a bittersweet day when the baseball season ends for me. You know, the sport's my first love, and it's what I grew up with. But in New England, it's a cause for celebration because it ends in championship fashion.
It's always good when the team wins their last game in the playoffs. It's usually a good sign.
It certainly is.
Here we are 2 days removed from the Red Sox winning their ninth World Series championship overall, fourth this century. And man, you know, we sit here every week, or we've sat here every week over the summer, kind of surprised at what the Red Sox have done. And I have to say, it's no different. I thought it would be a longer series. I favored the Red Sox, but thought it'd be a longer series. And, you know, they lost one game, an 18-inning marathon. Otherwise, they really were in command. And, you know, they delivered.
Yeah, I think the best thing that you could say about the Sox, and probably the key to them winning in the fashion that they did in the playoffs, is they just treated it like the regular season. You know, they were serial winners during the regular season. They won 108 games. And I know, you know, they were the focus of a little bit of ridicule. That win total was, you know, thought to be inflated because competitive balance being what it is in baseball now, a lot of teams are either tanking or, you know, sort of at the bottom, losing 100 games, you know, struggling as franchises. But the fact is, the Red Sox still did that over 6 months to fellow professionals. It was impressive just on its face. The way that they were able to go through the playoffs, beating the Yankees and the Astros, 200-win teams, going 5-0 in their buildings,
right,
was very, very impressive to start off. And then if we're being fair now, in hindsight, we could take a step back from the matchup with the Dodgers and we could say, right, the Red Sox were 17 games better than the Dodgers this year. The Dodgers went 91-71. Yeah. So if we're being honest and we're being objective, the Red Sox always should have been favorites in this series, and pretty much went out and did, in my mind, what they were supposed to do.
Absolutely. So there's a lot to talk about in this series. Lots of drama, lots of decisions that we're going to hit on. But before we do any of that, I want to ask you about when the Red Sox clinched the game and won the game. What was the feeling like and what was the atmosphere like? Obviously, you're scurrying, right? You're trying to get down there and talk to the players, but give us a sense of that.
Well, once Steve Pierce homered in the eighth to make it 5-1, you got the sense that it wasn't coming back.
Right.
You know, Los Angeles, they looked a beaten team by that point. And I think it was just an accumulation of what happened in Game 4 and how Game 5 started, how the Red Sox were just able to sort of add on to the lead. It was 2-1 for a long time. Betts homers 3-1. Martinez homers 4-1, and LA wasn't really making any inroads on David Price. So it gets to 5-1 in the eighth, and you start to think, okay, how am I going to write my story? What's going to happen here? Who do I want to put up top?
Right.
I need to get some historical perspective in there because the Red Sox winning four World Series appearances in a row, only two other teams have done that. Only two other teams have won more games in a single season, the 1998 Yankees, who won 125, and the 2001 Mariners, who won 120 and actually didn't win a World Series. So you want to make sure that you get that across. The postgame between the television presentation of the trophy and the MVP on Fox takes a little bit of time. The clubhouse at Dodger Stadium is extremely small. So a lot of the players lingered out on the field with their families, and it's like trying to find needles in haystacks when you're trying to interview the relevant guys of the game, whether it be Steve Pierce, Mookie Betts, David Price. So you sort of look for camera clusters.
Right.
Because you figure if the cameras are in a big group in a certain place, they're probably around a player you want to talk
sure.
to. Sure. And you're sort of given free rein on the field at Dodger Stadium. You can go around and try to get some guys. And you know, I was fortunate enough to get a few guys. And you know, the production staff here at the Journal, the Night Sports guys, you know, Mark Diver, Mark Castingay, yourself, obviously, were great. In terms of giving some extra time for the Game 5 story to make it into the paper. Kevin McNamara, my co-conspirator out in L.A., was terrific. You know, Kevin's obviously done this for a long time, has done many World Series, and, you know, really was able to settle me down in a couple moments where I was on the verge of coming unglued. you know, but it's a very hectic atmosphere, and you only really have a chance now to sort of step back and appreciate what they did
right
over the course of the year. And so that's part of the reason why you want to do a sort of season-ending podcast, because it really was a historic season for the Red Sox.
It really was. And, you know, there were lots of questions and some legitimate doubts along the way. Obviously, the bullpen was chief among them, and you know, hats off really to Alex Cora, because what he did was he came up with the Rover and put a starting pitcher in there to pitch a key inning late in the game. Now this would be somebody who would be scheduled to throw a bullpen anyway, so instead of throwing a bullpen, you're coming in and pitching a World Series game. Why not? And but it worked out well for the Sox. So let's dig in here. And the first question I want to pose to you is the whole MVP situation.
Sure.
Steve Pierce gets the MVP, 8 RBIs, 3 home runs, clearly a huge impact on this series. But, you know, I think the other person that was in strong contention for that was David Price, who, you know, completed his sort of redemption tour here. Won 2 games, pitched a key inning in relief. And, you know, that Game 5 closeout was a surprise, because we were all expecting Chris Sale was going to get the start until very late the night before, when Alex Cora just kind of says, oh, by the way, Price is going tomorrow, right?
Right.
So what do you think of the MVP vote? If you had – you to be clear, you did not have a vote
in
the MVP.
Not.
But if you did, where do you think you would have voted?
I have to admit that I was torn between those two guys. Mm. You know, obviously, with Pierce doing what he did in Game 4, which I think was the most critical game of the series, you know, tying the game with a solo home run, and then the insurance that he gave with a 3-run double in the 9th, that really took, you know, all the steam out of the Dodgers at that point. And then the way he started Game 5 sort of set the tone for Game 5 with a 2-run homer in the first inning. You have a 2-0 lead after 3 batters. I think those 3 swings that he made were critical in terms of the Red Sox regaining and then maintaining control of the series. But David Price, you know, to his credit, threw the ball well in Game 2, you know, got himself into a bit of a jam in the 4th inning and was able to get himself out. He limited the damage to 2 runs. That was all the Dodgers got that night against him. Game 3 came in relief, you know, on 1 full day of rest, and got a couple outs in that marathon. And then in Game 5, it was more an extension of what he did against Houston in Game 5 of the ALCS. He makes a start on short rest. He gives up a first-pitch home run to David Freese, walks Justin Turner on 5 pitches, has Manny Machado 3-0. This is all in the first inning.
Yeah.
You could make a reasonable guess that he was a little jittery there, and previous versions of David Price in playoff starts might not have gotten out of the first inning, might have melted down. You know, things might have gone completely sideways. What does he do? He gets Kike Hernandez to ground into a double play. He gets Manny Machado to get himself out. So he gets through the first inning. He doesn't lose the lead. In the third, David Freese hits a ball into the twilight that J.D. Martinez loses. It's a triple. It's a man at third at one out, and Price doesn't let him score either.
Right.
And those two instances, in the first and in the third, just illustrated the growth and the maturity that he's shown throughout this postseason. And so probably based on that character that Price showed, just that determination that he showed, his ability to completely reverse the personal narrative that had carried into this October for him, and it was a deserved one.
Right.
I think I probably would have voted for David Price. I think I would have. You know, just because I feel like his sort of story arc here, a guy who lasted 10 batters against the Yankees, going from there to a guy who sets you up to win the World Series and wins two games in the World Series, I think he was probably the choice. But I can't really quibble with taking Steve Pierce either.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think Steve Pierce is certainly a worthy choice as well. But I think that you touched upon it there when you said the story arc. I mean, those of us who've been following the Red Sox all year sort of know the saga of David Price. And this ending is sort of a storybook ending for him, which probably plays a larger role for us because we're covering the Red Sox and we see what's happened with Price. Because really, it's remarkable. You know, how many times have we sat in this studio over the summer, Bill, and said about Chris Sale, you know, the Red Sox aren't going to go anywhere without Chris Sale in the postseason,
sure.
Right? And that we were certainly supportive of the Sox keeping him on the bench or on the DL to get him rested and ready. And while he certainly did not have a bad postseason, he wasn't the ace that people were expecting.
No.
And I mean, in the World Series, I think he pitched only five innings. I think he gave up three runs, a home run. And I mean, you know, he kept the Red Sox in the game in the games that he pitched, but he was not, you know, the lights out stopper that you were expecting or hoping. David Price was the guy that really carried that pitching staff. So I think from that perspective, I probably would have voted for Price too, but it's hard to knock what Steve Pierce did because he really did carry that offense and come up with such timely hits. And, you know, hey, maybe it could have been a co-MVP award and the folks at Chevy would have had to give out two trucks.
Well, seeing what David Price drives, it looks like an armored assault vehicle. you know, it's this big tank looking, you know, sort of Range Rover on steroids. I think he might have declined the truck or donated it somewhere. He does have a charitable bent. To him, I know he's done a lot of work back home in Tennessee with charities. So, you know, had he won the truck, that might have been a tax write off at some point. You know, but Price threw 13 2/3 innings in the series. That was 5 2/3 more than any other Red Sox pitcher.
Right.
Wow. You know, and you look at the job that he did over those 13 2/3, a 1.98 ERA and a 0.95 WHIP. You know, it was quality stuff. You know, against a lineup that, fairly or unfairly, they do have some holes, but they had gone to the World Series 2 years in a row.
Right.
There's something to be said for the way that Price threw the ball in his appearances in the World Series. And he let us know about it, too, by the way.
That's right. Yeah, that post-game press conference, he made sure that you guys knew that he knew that you knew that he knew. Right?
I'd be interested to get your thoughts on his comments there.
The thing about holding all the cards now.
Yes.
I say good for him. I really do.
Because, I'm with you.
Because, you know, he has been the target of a lot of criticism. And you know, I think the criticism was justified. He stunk it up on a lot of occasions. But when you step up on the biggest stage, when everybody is always doubting you. I mean, he pitched a very good, game two.
Game two, yes.
And people were still doubting him. You know, they're saying, well, yeah, that's fine, but he's going to revert to the guy that was on the mound in Yankee Stadium. And then he comes out in relief, pitches a good two batters,
three batters of an inning.
Right, and then he comes out and obviously pitches a great game in the closeout in game five. Good for him. You know, that's what sports is all about. People doubt you. You prove them wrong. You get to bang your chest a little bit.
See, for me, and I agree with you, good for him, fine. You know, that's your platform. You want to say it, say it. That's the perfect place to do it. I also think with Price, he's a sensitive guy. You could see later when someone asked him about what his teammates mean to him.
Yeah.
He got choked up and he had to pause for about 30 seconds and he said they mean a lot.
Yeah.
He said the relationships are what you remember about this game, and it's why we play. It's for the other guys in the clubhouse. And, you know, just talking to some of the other guys, Mookie Betts, chief among them, couldn't have been happier for him. You know, Jackie Bradley has been a defender of Price. throughout the season, you know, constantly maintain faith in him. Alex Cora as well. For Price, for me, I think a lot of his tenure in Boston, yes, his performance has been criticized, but I think it's gone beyond that at times. And, and I think that's where it sort of veers into something that's unfair. You know, people have made fun of his allergies or his carpal tunnel or him playing Fortnite or, you know, him sort of sounding depressed and, you know, sort of sounding like, you know, people have said, oh, he plays the victim or whatever else. I think you can criticize performance, but once you get into criticizing someone as a person, I think that's where it gets over the line, and that's probably why Price sort of felt the need to strike back while he was on top of the mountain. And in that respect, I say good for him because he's got the hammer now. He's not wrong. You know, the next time he goes out against the Yankees, if he gets hit around, that's fine. People were right that he got hit around, but it's not going to be he's a choke, he's a dog, he can't win in the playoffs.
Yeah.
All of that is done. He's put that all to rest. And I think very much for the better for himself and for the Red Sox, really, going forward, because they don't have to answer that question now either.
No, no. So, yeah, certainly, you know, it couldn't have worked out better for David Price in October. And we'll see if he's still with the team. I kind of think he's going to be. Hard for me to believe he's going to walk away from the guaranteed money. But, you know, you never know. He pitched really well. Maybe there's another team out there that thinks, hey, we can take this guy on for a few years, and maybe he accepts to accepts a little bit of a dip in salary. I mean, I can't imagine anyone's going to pay him more than what he's making now.
Well, maybe he says mission accomplished.
Yeah.
You know, I came to Boston to win a championship and win games in the postseason. I did it. You know, it hasn't always been the easiest for him here. You know, maybe he has family who lives in other parts of the country that he'd like to, you know, pitch close to. Maybe he'd like to be closer to home in Tennessee. You know, the Cardinals were a big suitor for him when he was a free agent. He was intrigued by their offer. The Red Sox just came in with so much more money.
Sure.
You know, and probably were better set up in terms of an organization with the young talent that they had to try to win a championship in the near future. You know, so maybe he looked at that and decided to sign here. I know he's cited, you know, seeing Xander Bogaerts and Mookie Betts and Jackie Bradley and thinking, I can go play with those guys. They're going to be very good. But you never know what someone is thinking. You know, and if he feels like it's mission accomplished and he's done what he set out to do here in Boston, he might decide to turn the page and move on. We'll see.
Yeah, yeah, maybe. Or, you know, maybe he feels, hey, I've slain the dragon. I'm a World Series hero now, so things are going to be easier for me. Now, maybe that may not be the case, but maybe that's one way of thinking. So, I also want to touch upon the 18-inning marathon was.
Is it over yet?
I think there's somebody else getting up in the warm in the bullpen right now.
Oh,
right?
My goodness.
That 18-inning marathon game three that, you know, you look at the box score and it still jumps out at you. Can't be right. The time of the game says 7 hours and 20 minutes. and obviously that's the lone game that the Red Sox lost, walk-off home run in the bottom of the 18th. But a couple of points I want to hit on here. First of all is the performance by Nathan Eovaldi, who took the loss, unfortunately, but man, he came in, he threw 97 pitches. Who knows if he would have kept pitching if they didn't end it there. But what a performance by Eovaldi.
No, it was the type of thing where you lost the game and you were still able to walk away from it feeling, I won't say good, but you took a huge positive out of it.
Sure.
The sacrifice that he made coming into that game in the 12th inning, and then once it got extended, staying in the game, pretty much costing himself a World Series start.
Yeah, essentially, right.
That's what happened. Yeah. You know, he was going to be in line to start game four, most likely, I would think, either game three or game four.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was just phenomenal. It was phenomenal to think that he pitched in relief in game one, he pitched in relief in game two. He had one full day rest. They're thinking he's going to come in and probably throw two or three innings and hopefully they'll win the game,
right,
which they should have done in the 13th. And he just keeps going and going and going. And he's throwing high 90s fastballs in the 17th inning, the 18th inning.
Yeah.
The effort that he gave, I think it was probably the best representation of, I think, why the Red Sox won this World Series. They were so invested in each game, in each inning, in each pitch. You had guys like David Price and Rick Porcello and Chris Sale going to Alex Cora and saying, use me.
Hmm.
I don't care if I'm tired or if you think I need rest or whatever, use me. Put me in the game. Let's go. You know, we only have two or three games left here in the season. So let's go. Let's leave it all out there. And that's not how you would manage your team, obviously, in the regular season. And a lot of times you can't manage your team that way in the postseason. Like in Game 4, Dave Roberts didn't have Pedro Baez. He didn't have Julio Urias. They were both unavailable. For the Red Sox, that word didn't exist.
Right.
You know, and you look and you just think, you think about the limits that these guys are willing to stretch to in order to win a championship, especially someone like Evaldi, who's going to be a free agent and who's risking his health, theoretically,
right
before he's set to cash in. I think his teammates all know that. They can appreciate not only the game, but the business side of the game and what he was truly risking by taking the ball as often as he did in uncustomary roles and giving them what he did. And so I think they were able to walk away from Game 3, a crushing loss, certainly, but not one that was going to finish the series on them.
No, and before we jump ahead here to the next game, what did you think of the whole Ian Kinsler play there? It just seemed odd that... He seemed like he had time there to make that play.
There were two things that happened in that game that convinced me that they weren't going to win it. In the 10th, you take your shot. You get a fly ball to medium-depth center field with Kinsler at third. Hmm. Cody Bellinger makes a strong throw. Not a great throw, but a strong throw up the line that gives Austin Barnes plenty of time to make the catch and tag Kinsler coming to the plate. If you're the Sox, you have to take a chance there. Why not?
Right.
You don't know how many more you're going to get.
Right.
Your lineup is sort of weird by that point. You end the game with Christian Vasquez and Sandy Leon hitting back-to-back, Mookie Betts and Xander Bogaerts, and then the pitcher spot, Evaldi, is hitting third.
That's right.
So how is your offense realistically supposed to score any runs?
Right.
Unless you hit a home run, you're not going to have a sustained rally.
Mm-hmm.
Then in the 13th, the Dodgers have a circus in the top of the inning where Nunez hits a little dribbler up the line at first. Scott Alexander throws it away. Brock Holt scores all the way from, you know, and it's 2-1.
Right.
You're thinking, here's your chance.
Yeah,
they just open the door.
Right.
You're going to win the game. You get into the 13th, and I understand what people are thinking in terms of pitching to Yasiel Puig there. Why would you do it with Austin Barnes on deck? He's an automatic out. I'm sure what the Red Sox are thinking is, we don't want to put the winning run on base. That's a cardinal baseball sin.
Right.
The matchups being what they are, you're sort of hesitant to do that. If someone hits a broken bat flare down the line in right field at that point, Puig could score all the way from first base. Who knows?
Right.
So he hits a pretty sharp ground ball up the middle. The field conditions in L.A. weren't great. Kinsler slips, and I think he panicked a little bit. He's thinking, I got the last out of this game in my glove.
Right.
It's the 13th inning. We got a chance to get out of this and take a stranglehold on the series. I'm just going to try and get it in the direction
of
first base. Even if it bounces, Vasquez will be able to corral it. We've seen their left side of the infield do that all year.
Mm.
Bogaerts has thrown the ball on one hop to first base. Nunez has done it as well. It's a pretty generally accepted strategy in baseball to try to do that now because the fields are so good. The only problem was Kinsler threw wide at first and Vasquez couldn't get it.
Right.
And when it goes to 2-2 at that point, I'm thinking they just had their two best chances to win this game. Mm. The lineup being what it is, I don't think they can score. You know, they've got J.D. Martinez out of the game.
Right.
They got the pitcher hitting third. They've got both catchers in the lineup. It's just probably not going to happen.
But did you think he was going to go on for another five innings before the Dodgers could score?
Well, the other side of that was the Red Sox had Evaldi out there.
Yeah.
And Evaldi had been, you know, just
right,
about...
Right, but at that point, we didn't know how much longer Evaldi... Like, I'm thinking, oh, he's got another inning in him, maybe two, you know?
Well, by that point, it was either they were going to go to Chris Sale, which I never thought they would do.
Yeah.
Or they were going to go to Drew Pomeranz, which, you know, obviously they didn't want to do because, you know, Pomeranz was the last guy on the roster, and
right.
you're really not comfortable... considering his control problems throughout the course of the year, you're really not comfortable putting him out there because he walks a couple guys, there's a broken bat single, you lose the game. I think they got to a point with Eovaldi where he was so extended, he wasn't going to be able to start game four or game five. And so you thought, we need to push him all the way back to game six after the off day. Let's just ride with him. Alex Cora said the 18th inning would have been his last inning. And Pomeranz had gotten up to warm.
Right.
Did I anticipate that we'd get all the way there? No. But I did think that the Red Sox had squandered their two best chances to win that game.
Right.
And I did not see them getting out of it.
So as it turns out, that is the one game that the Dodgers were able to win. And so I was very interested to see what the reaction would be in game four. And the answer is that the Red Sox bounced right back. They answered the bell. I think from that point on, and you just shared this a little while ago, you felt pretty good about the series in terms of the Red Sox winning.
Well, once they won game four, yeah, certainly.
But even just coming back and answering and not laying down in game four.
It didn't look good for a while.
Yeah.
The only time in the series where I really felt like the Red Sox were in any trouble at all was when Yasiel Puig homered in game four.
Right.
It was a sixth inning. It's a 1-0 game. Eduardo Rodriguez gave them everything they could have asked for in a spot start there. And Alex Cora admitted after the game he pushed him and left him one batter too long. He throws a 3-1 fastball out over the plate, and Puig hits it pretty much to the San Gabriel Mountains. I mean, he crushed that ball to left field. And I'll tell you this. You know, L.A. fans get a rap for being soft and for only caring about the beach or whatever else. It sounded like a rocket took off in Dodger Stadium when Puig hit that ball.
Yeah.
You know, that sound that crowd make, it actually shook the press box.
Wow.
Which is on the fifth level. It's a 9-level stadium. It's stunning as a fan. If you ever get a chance to go out to the West Coast and go to a Dodger game, do it, because it's absolutely stunning. One of the most beautiful places I've been in my media career. Mm-hmm. But when he homers to make it 4-0 in the sixth, and Rich Hill's throwing the way he did on the other side, I'm thinking, oh boy, this is going to go to 2-2, and from there, you got a 3-game series for the World Series. There's no guarantees at that point.
No, truth be told, when Puig hit that and they went up 4-0, I'm thinking, okay, this is a 7-game series.
Yes.
But the Red Sox answered, and answered pretty quickly.
It was strange the way that the top of the seventh inning unfolded there. You know, with Hill allegedly going to Dave Roberts in between innings and saying, you need to keep an eye on me, I'm probably batter for batter here. To Roberts removing Hill to face a left-hander.
Yeah, it was
brought
strange.
In a left-hander to face a left-hander. Scott Alexander walks Brock Holt, which you put that on the player. He didn't execute.
Mm.
You need to throw a strike to Brock Holt. You just have to. Now you get two men on. You bring in Ryan Madsen, who had a nightmare in this series. He allowed all seven of his inherited runners to score. Two guys there. He gets Jackie Bradley Jr. out. And then Mitch Moreland, being the savvy veteran that he is, sees Madsen start off Bradley with back-to-back changeups and says, I'm going to sit on a changeup first pitch. Madsen throws him one up and out over the plate. Moreland hits it into the bleachers and right. All of a sudden, it's 4-3. And the Red Sox are looking out at the Dodger bullpen and thinking, we can get these guys.
Hmm.
We've done it before already in the series. We've scored on these guys. And then when Pierce homers in the eighth against Kenley Jansen, and it's the second straight night that Jansen has blown a save in the eighth inning, there was only going to be one outcome there.
Yeah.
In my mind, they were not losing that game once they tied it.
Mm-hmm.
Los Angeles looked like a beaten team. You could see the body language in their dugout. They were in real trouble. The only other jam the Red Sox really had was in the eighth inning. Joe Kelly comes in. The Dodgers single twice. They have the go-ahead run on base. And he blows away Yasmani Grandal with a fastball up and away to set up a 5-run ninth inning. Just the way that it turned so quickly, you know, maybe in the span of 30, 45 minutes,
right.
Los Angeles lost the series right there.
Mm-hmm. And that was the Kimbrel came into that game. Is that the
he did? It was 9-4,
right? And he gave up a 2-run hit, bomb.
Had some trouble. He had Blake Swihart behind the plate,
yeah.
Who I don't know if he's thrown to all year.
Right.
You know, didn't really look confident. Threw a first pitch curveball that Swihart didn't catch.
Yeah,
that was right down the middle.
Yeah, it was.
And from that point, Kimbrel's probably thinking, oh boy, how am I going to get through this?
Like, he needs any more drama.
Well, and he was tired, too. I mean, he had worked the first three games. Mm-hmm. He was probably unavailable for game five.
Right.
I think that's probably why you saw Chris Sale at the end. I do not think that Kimbrel was going to pitch in that game. I think Alex Cora was going to give him 2 days off and have him fresh for game six and maybe extend him to 20, 25 pitches if he needed it.
Sure, sure. And then in game five, the Red Sox didn't leave much doubt, right? They jumped out early, and you could just tell the Dodgers just didn't have a comeback in them.
No, the only trouble spots really were, you know, after Pierce homers in the first, you have a 2-0 lead after three batters.
Right.
You're in control of the game at that point. And you have no reasonable expectation to be shut down by Clayton Kershaw because he struggled so much in the postseason. And frankly, his stuff was so average. Four-seam fastballs at 91 miles an hour. This lineup can hit that. There's not much separation anymore between the fastball and the slider. They pretty much turned the curveball into a non-pitch. They weren't going to swing at it. The only trouble spots for Price were really in the first. Mm. When he walks Justin Turner after the home run, he gets Kike Hernandez to ground into a double play. That's big to settle him down. And then obviously Freeze in the third when he reaches and is stranded on third base with one out. After that, both guys dominated into the sixth. Mookie Betts homers, it's 3-1. And then Martinez homers to lead off the seventh. And from that point, when it's 4-1, after everything that had happened in game four and the way the Red Sox have been all season, just sort of this relentless, grinding collection of 25 guys who have all contributed to this, you got the sense that they just weren't going to give it up.
No, absolutely not. And, you know, obviously Pierce hits another home run. They go up 5-1. And then we see Chris Sale come out of the bullpen to nail it down. And, you know, it was, it seemed to be over in a flash. The managers were interesting to me in this series. Cora, for the most part, could do no wrong. I mean, he'd bring in a pinch hitter, the guy would hit a home run, right? You know, brings in Kelly at the right time, shuts down the threat. I mean, for the most part, Cora's moves were unquestioned. On the other side of the field, you had Dave Roberts, who we talked about the Rich Hill thing. You know, the other thing that puzzled me is, you know, you've got these really good hitters like Cody Bellinger, and they're not playing in the first couple of games. And I get it; it's the whole lefty righty thing. But the thing about the Dodgers that I, you know, thought, unlike most of the other National League contenders, are that, you know, they're more like an American League team because they have power up and down that lineup. And, you know, you're sitting some of your best hitters against a team that you know is going to score runs. Now, I get it; I understand that. Matchups say one thing, but you got a bat like Cody Bellinger, man. Put him in the game.
Yeah, that was. I really struggled with that too. You know, first for Cora, the one major decision that obviously could have blown up in his face was burning Eovaldi in a loss.
Right.
You know, you basically threw away a starter. You forced Eduardo Rodriguez out there for game four.
Mm-hmm.
And you're down 4-0 in game four.
Right.
So the two worst decisions he made were. You know, he let Eovaldi get extended, and you lose. If you let him get extended and you win, you look
no
like a genius.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Absolutely.
That was the way, to be fair to Cora, though, that was the way he managed the whole postseason. If he felt like he had a chance to win the game, he was going to shove all the chips in.
Right.
So his consistency of decision-making was fine. Mm-hmm. You can quibble with the decision itself. That's okay. You know, and then in game four, he left Rodriguez too long.
Right.
He had Matt Barnes up in the bullpen in the sixth inning.
Right. And he said so.
Yeah. And see, I think that has allowed Cora to sort of build some credibility, not only with his players, but with the fan base, with the media.
Mm.
He comes right out and says, I pushed Rodriguez too hard.
Yeah.
I should have gone and got him. It doesn't seem like much, to admit to that.
Right, because that's what most people who know anything about the game, watching the game, are saying to themselves, why is he still in there?
But it is shocking how many guys, once they get up at the podium or they have all the cameras and the microphones around them, can't do that,
yeah.
are incapable of admitting that they made a mistake. And I think Cora's humanity in that way has probably made him very relatable, not only to his players, but to the fan base and to the folks who cover him. He's very good, very accountable in that way, and if he's going to preach accountability, he's practicing it himself.
Right.
In terms of Dave Roberts, the lineups being what they are, I'm with you. I understand that that's what they did all year and that you're going to play righties against a left-handed pitcher and you're going to play lefties against a right-handed pitcher and that it worked. But if you look at the Red Sox staff and you realize that it is pretty much left-handed, you're going to have Price, you're going to have Sale, you're going to have Rodriguez potentially in a game four. When you see the starting lineups for those three games, you can't just say, we're going to take some of our best guys and put them to the side. It's a short series. It's right. not 162 games.
Right.
There's no reason that Kike Hernandez should be playing over Cody Bellinger. He was awful the whole postseason. Austin Barnes was an out for the most part. He went 0 for 11 in the World Series. Chris Taylor was an out. He went 2 for 14 in the World Series.
Right.
I can understand maybe keeping Jock Peterson aside. Mm-hmm. Because, as Cora did, you want to have an opposite bat for when they go to the bullpen. So, like, if they go to Matt Barnes or Joe Kelly, you can bring a left-handed pinch hitter in off the bench for somebody. That's a good option to have. That makes the other manager maybe hesitate in terms of his bullpen decisions, his matchups at the end, especially in an NL park where you have to double switch, and should we take the starting pitcher out at this point, or should we let him bat one more time? And that's a good idea to have some balance on your bench mm-hmm. in that way. The Red Sox did a pretty good job of that throughout the postseason. Like, he would play Kinsler and Nunez, but he would keep a lefty out. Or he would play, you know, Moreland and Devers, but he would keep a righty out.
Right.
Like, that was, he did a good job of balancing his roster in that way. The Dodgers just completely abandoned that. They just said, we're either going to play the lefties or play the righties. It allowed the Red Sox to game plan in a way for what they were going to do. So that hamstrings them from a day-to-day perspective. And then obviously the Rich Hill thing in game four. I posed this question to you before we came on, and it's one that they would never answer, of course, but what if Hill never goes to Roberts in the sixth or before the seventh and says, hey, you got to watch me. I might be running out of gas. Does Roberts maybe perceive any signs of slippage? Is he looking for something
right.
at that point on purpose? You know, so that when Hill walks Xander Bogaerts to lead off the inning,
right, he takes that as a cue.
Right.
Sure.
Is he even thinking that way
yeah.
if Hill never says something?
Well, you know,
we'll never know.
Well, Hill wanted out of that game, I think. I mean, when Roberts went out to the mound, there was no discussion. Rich Hill just handed them the ball, you know, and we hear the sort of give and take afterwards, you know, like, I just assumed Roberts, the manager, was coming to take me out, and Roberts says, well, he just handed me the ball. And, you know, I think if you're Rich Hill and you felt like, you know, you wanted to stay in there, you would not give the manager the ball so readily and, you know, try and state your case. And, but I think Dave Roberts, as you said, was looking for, you know, okay, well, he told me this, so here's the spot where I'm going to go out, and he hands me the ball. Okay, let's, you know, get the next guy in. And, you know, Hill had been very effective, obviously, in that game. So you wonder if he left him in there for a little bit longer, if the outcome would have been any different.
Well, and especially that you pull him facing a lefty.
Yeah, you're right.
Couldn't he pitch to Holt?
Right, of course.
Right, wouldn't you let him pitch to Brock Holt?
Yeah, I mean, he's not a 100-mile-an-hour guy whose velocity is all of a sudden down to 89
right.
at this point.
You know. And even if they pinch hit, let's say they pinch hit Kinsler in that spot, you let him pitch to Kinsler. I think he went 1-for-10 in the series.
Yeah, no, he didn't have a good series at all.
So why wouldn't it just... And I guess the bottom line in all of this, and it goes back to something that Cora did very well throughout the season, whether it be with his players or with the media, and it's something that they cited throughout the year, is that he communicated very well.
Mm.
guys knew their roles. They knew when they were going to play. They knew when they were going to start. They knew when they were going to get a couple days off.
Right.
He was able to explain his decisions, whether it be to his players or to us, very clearly, very concisely. He was very consistent throughout the year, whether they were winning three in a row or losing three in a row. You know, Chris Sale said on multiple occasions in this World Series, when you have a manager who you look over at and he's in the dugout and you can't tell if it's 1-0 or 10-0, you feel great because there's the leader and that's the tone that he's setting. And so I think this entire kerfuffle in Game 4 between Roberts and Hill and whether or not they should have gone to the bullpen and whether or not Hill was asking out of the game or whatever else, I couldn't envision something like that happening with Cora in charge.
No. I think Bill Reynolds had a good line in today's Providence Journal in his column when he called him the Zen manager.
He has been.
Yeah, he's just sort of, you know, kind of struck that same tone, never seemed to get too riled up. Obviously, he was sort of in tune with all his players. And hey, you know, I don't know if that's a product of winning or that's the cause of winning, but either way, you don't argue with the results here.
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. He obviously set the tone when he got the job, flying around the country, meeting with these guys, whether it be for lunch, for dinner. The guys who live in Boston, he met with them, whether it be at Hotel Commonwealth. I know he met with Mookie Betts. He flew in and met with him.
Mm-hmm.
Florida, before spring training, he had a lunch with Chris Sale and Jackie Bradley and Sandy Leone and Christian Vasquez. And, you know, he had ideas for these guys, and he had thoughts on how they play and how he felt like they could improve them. And he just kept those lines open throughout the year, and I think it was something that he established very early. And it's something that was so ingrained in them that by the time you got to October, it wasn't going to buckle under the pressure.
Right, right. And it didn't. So before we wrap up this podcast, and I think we should do one more anyway, Bill. Don't you think we'll do like a free agent kind of look ahead?
Yeah, got to do Hot Stove.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Absolutely.
It's already started today.
Yeah,
with the Red Sox announcing that they picked up Chris Sale's option for 2019.
Right, which is a no-brainer, right? You're going to keep him for one more year if you can for $15 million.
Has to be. He's right. Going to make $15 million. It was going to be 13.5, but since he finished second in Cy Young voting, that kicked an escalator in his contract up to $15 million.
Right.
You know, and this is certainly a team that is built to contend again in 2019. This makes for a huge walk year in 2020, and we'll get into this more later on. But Chris Sale, Rick Porcello, Xander Bogaerts, Mitch Moreland, Eduardo Nunez, Brock Holt will all be free agents after the 2019 season.
Right.
Some big names there.
Sure.
But you return just about everyone of value. You know, the guys who you're losing, Craig Kimbrell, Ian Kinsler, Drew Pomeranz, Steve Pearce, Joe Kelly, Nathan Eovaldi, Brandon Phillips. Some important names there, too.
Sure.
But enough of the core comes back where you're going to feel good about this group going forward. And we'll get into more detail on that in a Hot Stove version of the Twin Bills.
Absolutely. And before we sign off today, I did want to ask you one more thing, and that's about the performance of Mookie Betts in the World Series.
Sure.
Defensively, he's fine. He never played second base. We kind of theorized whether he would or not. Never got there, unless he did and I missed it. Maybe he played in the 14th and 15th inning of that game where I was sleeping.
Why?
And then I woke up for the 18th. But
I think we saw why he didn't play second base in the first inning in Game 3. Believe it or not.
What did he do?
Max Muncy overslid the bag.
Oh.
And almost killed Brock Holt.
That's right.
And Holt, being a second baseman, his instincts being a second baseman, a guy who's played the position a lot recently, was able to sort of take a step back behind the bag, take the contact from Muncy and sort of lean down. And they had a very nice moment, actually, where Muncy apologized to Holt, and Holt said, "That's okay,
right,
man."
And avoided
if
any
I was
kind
Holt,
of bad,
I,
right?
If I was Holt, I might not have been as sportsmanlike right. in that spot because it looked completely unnecessary from Muncy. And at that point, you immediately think, would Mookie Betts have had the wherewithal to not get hurt here.
Good question. Yeah,
to get out of the way.
Not familiar with it, obviously. So.
That was a scary moment, and I think Cora was probably visualizing something like that. Certainly had Manny Machado on his mind. He's out there cleating everybody in these playoffs. He took out Dustin Pedroia in 2017.
Right.
So a little risk averse there, and you can't really blame him.
No, no. But at the plate, he was less than overwhelming. He obviously did have that solo shot in the last game. But overall, he hit .217, one RBI. And we're talking about the guy that's probably going to win the AL MVP. Concerned? Do you think it's just one of those things? Do you think something was going on that we don't know about?
No, I think he probably was just pressing a little bit. I think Mookie's the type of guy, and not unlike David Price, maybe not to that extent, but guy who wants to win badly, wants the approval of his teammates, wants to be a good player, but is just so humble. You go back to some of Tim Britton's coverage of Mookie when he came up with the Red Sox, and he talks about how he thought Jackie Bradley was a better player and how he felt lucky to get out of Double A and play in Pawtucket. I think he took an O for his first game in Pawtucket. Then the next night he has three hits, a home run, a double. And he's saying, man, Triple A pitching is tough. I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to hit these guys. And it's like, Mookie, just go out there and play. Right. Like you're freak talent. And that's something that Cora's tried to unlock in him all year. Go out and swagger around. Have some confidence. Talk some trash. You're a great player. Go ahead and do it. Had three hits in game two. That was certainly his best game. Had a big home run in game five. Played good defense in the outfield. He did not cost them the series.
No, not at all.
And I think it speaks to the general strength of this team and probably why they were able to win so much. When you look at some of the performances in the series, Martinez went 5-for-18 on a bad angle. Bogarts went 3-for-22. Didn't do much of anything.
No.
Moreland went 1-for-8. The only hit he had was a 3-run homer. Kinsler went 1-for-10. He had an RBI single. So it's like, you had some of your horses. Chris Sale.
Right.
We've gone over Chris Sale throughout this podcast. Was not the stud that he was in June and July.
5 innings, 3 runs, and a home run. No, certainly not.
But the collection, the efforts of the group are how you win 119 games. And I think Betts didn't do anything to cost them the series, nor did Bogarts, nor did Martinez in the grand scheme. And you wonder if they're able to get back there in 2019. We certainly saw with David Price what just winning one game unlocked in him. What's this going to do for Mookie Betts, for Xander Bogarts going forward? What's it going to mean for their confidence that they're young players, some of the best players on a World Series winner? It can only do great things for them going forward.
Well, we'll be here to write about it and talk about it. Bill, it's been great doing this podcast all season long.
No, it's been a lot of fun, Bill.
And we got one more in us here. We'll do the hot stove version probably next week after. But, boy, not a bad finish to your rookie year covering the Red Sox, I would say.
You're telling me. You get to finish it in Los Angeles with a World Series title. Got to watch the MVP play all year. Betts. I'd be shocked within the next couple of weeks if he's not named the AL MVP. Have so much talent going forward. Someone had a friend ask me, probably like in the dog days of August, how do you keep it fresh? How do you find something different to write about every day? It's the Red Sox.
Yeah.
They're always going to have a storyline. They're always going to have a superstar. They're always going to be worth watching.
Yeah, if you couldn't find fresh things to write about this year when they're winning all these games and winning a World Series, you're not going to find stuff to write about any year. So anyway, Bill, thanks again, and we will do this again another week or so.
All right. Thanks, Bill.